She enunciated this last softly and slowly, worried what this news might do to such a seemingly fragile man. But Solo nodded, as if this made sense. It was not the reaction Juliet had expected.
"The outside?"
Solo looked again at the knife. He reached out of the hole and set it on the grating, slid it away from both of them.
"Is it safe?"
Juliet shook her head. "No," she said. "I had a suit. It wasn't a far walk, but still I shouldn't be alive." Solo bobbed his head. He looked up at her, wet tracks running from the corners of his eyes and disappearing into his beard.
"None of us should," he said. "Not a one."
47. Give leave a while. We must talk in secret. "What is this place?" Lucas asked Bernard. The two of them stood before a large chart hanging on the wall like a tapestry. The diagrams were precise, the lettering ornate. It showed a grid of circles evenly spaced with lines between them and intricacies inside each. Several of the circles were crossed out with thick red marks of ink. It was just the sort of majestic diagramming he hoped to achieve one day with his star charts. "This is our legacy," Bernard said simply. Lucas had often heard him speak similarly of the mainframes upstairs. "Are these supposed to be the servers?" he asked, daring to rub his hands across a piece of paper the size of a small bedsheet. "They're laid out like the servers." Bernard stepped beside him and rubbed his chin.
Interesting. So they are. I never noticed that before."
"What are they?" Lucas looked closer and saw each was numbered. There was also a jumble of squares and rectangles in one corner with parallel lines spaced between them, keeping the blocky shape separate and apart. These figures contained no detail within them, but the word Atlanta was written in large letters beneath.
"We'll get to that. Come, let me show you something."
At the end of the room was a door. Bernard led him through this, turning on more lights as he went. "Who else comes down here?" Lucas asked, following along. Bernard glanced back over his shoulder.
"No one."
Lucas didn't like that answer. He glanced back over his own shoulder, feeling like he was descending into something people didn't return from.
"I know this must seem sudden," Bernard said.
He waited for Lucas to join him, threw his small arm around Lucas's shoulder.
"But things changed this morning. The world is changing, and she rarely does it pleasantly."
"Is this about the cleaning?" he'd nearly said Juliet. The picture of her felt hot against his breastbone. Bernard's face grew stern.
"There was no cleaning," he said abruptly. "And now all hell will break loose, and people will die. And the silos, you see, were designed from the ground down to prevent this."
"Designed," Lucas repeated. His heart beat once, twice. His brain whirred through its circuits and finally computed that Bernard had said something that had made no sense.
"I'm sorry," he said. "Did you say silos?"
"You'll want to familiarize yourself with this."
Bernard gestured toward a small desk which had a fragile-looking wooden chair tucked up against it. There was a book on the desk unlike any Lucas had ever seen or even heard of. It was nearly as thick as it was wide. Bernard patted the cover and inspected his palm for dust.
"I'll give you the spare key, which you are never to remove from your neck. Come down when you can and read. Our history is in here, as well as every action you are to take in any emergency."
Lucas approached the book, a lifetime's worth of paper, and hinged open the cover. The contents were machine printed, the ink pitch black. He flipped through a dozen pages of listed contents until he found the first page of the main text. Oddly, he recognized the opening lines immediately.
"It's the pact," he said, looking up at Bernard.
"I already know quite a bit of—"
"This is the pact," Bernard told him, pinching the first half inch of the thick book. "The rest is the order."
He stepped back. Lucas hesitated, digesting this, then reached forward and flopped the tome open near its middle. "In the event of an earthquake, for casement cracking and outside leak, see airlock breach, page 2180. For collapse of one or more levels, see support columns under sabotage, page 751. For fire outbreak, see—"
"Sabotage?"
Lucas flipped a few pages and read something about air handling and asphyxiation.
"Who came up with all this stuff?"
"People who experienced many bad things."
"Like?"
He wasn't sure if he was allowed to say this,
but it felt like taboos were allowed to be broken down there. Like the people before the uprising?
The people before those people, Bernard said. The one people.
Lucas closed the book. He shook his head, wondering if this was all a gag, some kind of initiation. The priests usually made more sense than this. The children's books, too. I'm not really supposed to learn all this, am I? Bernard laughed. His countenance had fully transformed from earlier.
You just need to know what's in there so you can access it when you need to.
What does it say about this morning? He turned to Bernard, and it dawned on him suddenly that no one knew of his fascination, his enchantment with Juliet. The tears had evaporated from his cheeks. The guilt of possessing her forbidden things had overpowered his shame for falling so hard for someone he hardly knew. And now the secret had wandered out of sight. It could be betrayed only by the flush he felt on his cheeks as Bernard studied him and pondered his question.
Page 72, Bernard said,
the humor draining from his face and replaced with the frustration from earlier. Lucas turned back to the book. This was a test, a shadowing rite. It had been a long time since he'd performed under a caster's glare. He began flipping through the pages and saw at once that the section he was looking for came right after the pact, was at the very beginning of the order. He found the page. At the very top, in bold print, it said, "In the event of a failed cleaning." And below this rested terrible words, strung into awful meaning. Lucas read the instructions several times just to make sure. He glanced over at Bernard, who nodded sadly, before Lucas turned back to the print. In the event of a failed cleaning, prepare for war. 48. Poor living corpse, closed in a dead man's tomb. Juliet followed Solo through the hole in the server room floor. There was a long ladder there, and a passageway that led to 35, a part of 35 she suspected was not accessible from the stairwell. Solo confirmed this as they ducked through the narrow passageway and followed a twisting and brightly lit corridor. A blockage seemed to have come unstuck from the man's throat, releasing a lone-stricken torrent. He talked about the servers above them, saying things that made little sense to Juliet, until the passageway opened into a cluttered room.
My home,
Solo said, spreading his hands. There was a mattress on the floor in one corner, a tangled mess of sheets and pillows trailing from it. A makeshift kitchen had been arranged across two shelving units, jugs of water, canned food, empty jars and boxes. The place was a wreck and smelled foul, but Juliet figured Solo couldn't see or smell any of that. There was a wall of shelves on the other side of the room stocked with metal canisters the size of large ratchet sets, some of them partially open. You live here alone? Juliet asked. Is there no one else? She couldn't help but hear the thin hope in her voice. Solo shook his head. What about further down? Juliet inspected her wound. The bleeding had almost stopped.
I don't think so, he said. Sometimes I do. I'll find a tomato missing, but I figure it's the rats.
He stared at the corner of the room.
Can't catch them all, he said. More and more of them.
Sometimes you think there's more of you, though? More survivors? She wished he would focus.
Yeah.
He rubbed his beard, looked around the room like there was something he should have been doing for her, something you offered guests.
I find things moved sometimes, find things left out, the grow lights left on. Then I remember I did them.
He laughed to himself. It was the first natural thing she'd seen him do, and Jules figured he'd been doing a lot of it over the years. You laughed either to keep yourself sane or because you'd given up on staying that way. Either way, you laughed.
Thought the knife in the door was something I did. Then I found the pipe, wondered if it was left behind by a really, really big rat.
Juliet smiled. I'm no rat, she said. She adjusted her tablecloth, patted her head, and wondered what had happened to her other scrap of cloth. Solo seemed to consider this. So how many years has it been? She asked.
34,
he said, no pause. 34 years since you've been alone? He nodded, and the floor seemed to fall away from her. Her head spun with the concept of that much time with no other person around. How old are you? She asked. He didn't seem all that much older than her.
50,
he said.
Next month, I'm pretty sure.
He smiled.
This is fun, talking.
He pointed around the room.
I talk to things sometimes, and whistle.
He looked straight at her.
I'm a good whistler.
Juliet realized she probably had only just been born when whatever happened here took place. How exactly have you survived all these years? She asked.
I don't know. Didn't set out to survive for years. Tried to last hours. I stack up, I eat, I sleep, and I...
He looked away, went to one of the shelves and sorted through some cans, many of them empty. He found one with the lid hinged open, no label, and held it out toward her.
Bean?
He asked. Her impulse was to decline, but the eager look on his poor face made it impossible. Sure, she said, and she realized how hungry she was. She could still taste the brackish water from earlier, the tang of stomach acid, the unripe tomato. He stepped closer, and she dug into the wet juice in the can and came out with a raw green bean. She popped it into her mouth and chewed.
And I poop,
he said bashfully while she was swallowing.
Not pretty.
He shook his head and fished for a bean.
I'm by myself, so I just go in apartment bathrooms until I can't stand the smell.
In apartments? Juliet asked. Solo looked for a place to sit down the beans. He finally did, on the floor, among a small pile of other garbage and bachelor debris.
Nothing flushes. No water. I'm by myself.
He looked embarrassed. Since you were 16, Juliet said, having done the math. What happened here 34 years ago? He lifted his arms.
What always happens. People go crazy. It only needs to happen once.
He smiled.
We get no credit for being sane, do we? I get no credit, even from me, from myself. I hold it together and hold it together, and I make it another day, another year, and there's no reward. Nothing great about me being normal, about not being crazy.
He frowned.
And you have one bad day and you worry for yourself, you know? It only takes one.
He suddenly sat down on the floor, crossed his legs, and twisted the fabric of his overalls where they bunched up at his knees.
Our silo had one bad day. It was all it took.
He looked up at Juliet.
No credit for all the years before that. Nope. You want to sit?
He gestured at the floor. Again, she couldn't say no. She sat down, away from the reeking bed, and rested her back against the wall. There was so much to digest. How did you survive? She asked. That bad day, I mean. And since? She immediately regretted asking. It wasn't important to know. But she felt some need, maybe to glimpse what awaited her. Maybe because she feared that surviving in this place could be worse than dying on the outside.
Staying scared, he said. My dad's caster was the head of IT. Of this place.
He nodded.
My dad was a big shadow. Knew about these rooms. One of maybe two or three who did. And just the first few minutes of fighting, he showed me this place, gave me his keys. He made a diversion, and suddenly I became the only one who knew about this place.
He looked down at his lap a moment, then back up. Juliet realized why he seemed so much younger. It wasn't just the fear, the shyness that made him seem that way. It was in his eyes. He was locked in the perpetual terror of his teenage ordeal. His body was simply growing old around the frozen husk of a frightened little boy. He licked his lips.
None of them made it, did they? The ones who got out?
Solo searched her face for answers. She could feel the dire hope leaking out of his pores.
No,
she said sadly, remembering what it felt like to wade through them, to crawl over them. It felt like weeks ago rather than days.
So you saw them out there? Dead?
She nodded. He dipped his chin.
The view didn't stay on for long. I only snuck up once in the early days. There was still a lot of fighting going on. As time went by, I snuck out more often and further. I found a lot of the mess they made. But I haven't found a body in...
He thought carefully.
Maybe 20 years?
So there were others in here for a while? He pointed toward the ceiling.
Sometimes they would come in here with the servers and fight. They fought everywhere. Got worse as it went along, you know. Fight over food, fight over women, fight over fighting.
He twisted at the waist and pointed back through another door.
These rooms are like a silo in a silo, made to last 10 years, but it lasts longer if you're solo.
He smiled.
What do you mean, a silo in a silo?
He nodded. Of course, he said. Sorry, I'm used to talking with someone who knows everything I know.
He winked at her, and Juliet realized he meant himself.
You don't know what a silo is.
Of course I do, she said. I was born and raised in a place just like this. I guess you could say that we're still having good days and not giving ourselves credit for them.
Solo smiled.
Then what's a silo?
He asked, that teenage defiance bubbling to the surface. It's... Juliet searched for the words. It's our home, a building like those over the hill, but underground. The silo is the part of the world you can live in. The inside, she said, realizing it was harder to define than she thought.
Solo laughed.
That's what the word means to you. And we use words all the time without really understanding them.
He pointed toward the shelf with all the metal canisters.
All the real knowing is in those. Everything that ever happened.
He shot her a look.
You've heard the term raging bull? Or someone being bullheaded?
She nodded. Of course.
But what's a bull?
He asked. Someone who's careless, or mean, like a bully. Solo laughed.
So much we don't know, he said.
He studied his fingernails.
A silo isn't the world. It's nothing. The term, this word, comes from a long time ago, back when crops grew in the outside further than you could see.
He waved his hand over the floor like it was some vast terrain.
Back when there were more people than you could count, back when everyone had lots of kids.
He glanced up at her. His hands came together and kneaded one another, almost as if embarrassed to bring up the making of kids around a woman.
They grew so much food, he continued, that even for all these people they couldn't eat it all, not at once, so they stored it away in case times got bad. They took more seeds of grain than you could count, and they would pour them into these great silos that stood above ground.
Above ground, Juliet said. Silos. She felt as though he must be making this up, some delusion he'd concocted over the lonely decades.
I can show you pictures,
he said petulantly, as if upset by her doubt. He got up and hurried to the shelf with the metal canisters. He read the small white labels on the bottom, running his fingers across them.
Ah!
He grabbed one. It looked heavy, and brought it to her. The clasp on the side released the lid, revealing a thick object inside.
Let me,
he said, even though she hadn't moved a muscle to help. He tilted the box and let the heavy object fall onto his palm, where it balanced expertly. It was the size of a children's book, but 10 or 20 times as thick. Still, it was a book. She could see the edges of miraculously fine-cut paper.
I'll find it, he said.
He flipped pages in large chunks, each flap of fortune and pressed paper clapping solidly against more fortunes. Then he whittled his search down more finely, a pinch at a time, before moving to a single page at a time.
Here,
he pointed. Juliet moved closer and looked. It was like a drawing, but so exact as to almost seem real. It was like looking at the view of the outside from the cafeteria, or the picture of someone's face on an ID, but in color. She wondered if this book had batteries in it. It's so real, she whispered, rubbing it with her fingers.
It is real, he said. It's a picture, a photograph.
Juliet marveled at the colors, the green field and blue sky reminding her of the lies she had seen in her visor's false images. She wondered if this was false as well. It looked nothing like the rough and smeared photos she'd ever seen.
These buildings?
He pointed to what looked like large white cans sitting on the ground.
These are silos. They hold seed for the bad times, for until the times get good again.
He looked up at her. They were just a few feet apart, Juliet and him. She could see the wrinkles around his eyes, could see how much the beard concealed his age. I'm not sure what you're trying to say, she told him. He pointed at her, pointed at his own chest.
We are the seeds, he said. This is a silo. They put us here for the bad times.
Who put us here? And what bad times? He shrugged.
But it won't work.
He shook his head and sat back on the floor and peered at the pictures in the massive book.
You can't leave seeds this long, he said. Not in the dark like this, nope.
He glanced up from the book and bit his lip, water welling up in his eyes.
Seeds don't go crazy, he told her. They don't. They have bad days and lots of good ones, but it doesn't matter.
You leave them and leave them, however many you bury, and they do what seeds do when they're left alone too long.
He stopped, closed the book, and held it to his chest. Juliet watched as he rocked back and forth ever so slightly. What do seeds do when they're left too long? She asked him. He frowned.
We rot, he said. All of us. We go bad down here, and we rot so deep that we won't grow anymore.
He blinked and looked up at her.
We'll never grow again.
49. If you had the strength of 20 men, it would dispatch you straight. The waiting beyond the stacks of supply was the worst. Those who could napped, most engaged in nervous banter. Knox kept checking the time on the wall, picturing all the pieces moving throughout the silo. Now that his people were armed, all he could hope for was a smooth and bloodless transfer of power. He hoped they could get their answers, find out what had been going on in IT, those secretive bastards, and maybe vindicate Jules. But he knew bad things could happen. He saw it on Mark's face, the way he kept looking at Shirley. The worry there was evident in the man's frown, the tilt of his eyebrows, the wrinkles above the bridge of his nose. Knox's shift leader wasn't hiding the concern for his wife as well as he probably thought he was. Knox pulled out his multi-tool and checked the blade. He flashed his teeth in the reflection to see if anything from his last meal was stuck there. As he was putting it away, one of Supply's shadows emerged from behind the stacks to let them know they had visitors. What color visitors? Shirley asked as the group gathered their guns and lurched to their feet. The young girl pointed at Knox.
Blue, same as you.
Knox rubbed the girl's head as he slipped between the shelving units. This was a good sign. The rest of his people from Mechanical were running ahead of schedule. He made his way to the counter while Mark gathered the others, waking a few, the extra rifles clattering as they were gathered up. As Knox rounded the counter, he saw Peter enter through the front door, the two supply workers guarding the landing having allowed him past. Peter smiled as he and Knox clasped hands. Members of Peter's refinery crew filled in behind, their customary black overalls replaced with a more discreet blue.
How goes it?
Knox asked.
The stairs sing with traffic, Peter said.
His chest swelled as he took in and held a deep breath, then blew it out. Knox imagined the pace they'd maintained to shave off so much time.
Everyone's underway?
He and Peter slid to the side while their two groups merged, members of supply introducing themselves or embracing those they already knew.
They are, he nodded. I'd give the last of them another half hour. Though I fear the whispers on Porter's lips travel even faster than we do.
He looked toward the ceiling.
I'd wager they echo above our heads even now.
Suspicions?
Knox asked.
Oh, aye. We had a run-in by the lower market. People wanted to know the fuss. Georgie gave them lip, and I thought it had come to blows.
God, and not in the mids yet.
Aye, can't help but think a smaller incursion would have had a greater chance of success.
Knox frowned, but he understood Peter's thinking so. The man was used to doing a great deal with only a handful of strong backs. But it was too late for them to argue over plans already in action.
Well, the blackouts have likely begun, Knox said. There's nothing to it but for us to chase them up.
Peter nodded gravely. He looked around the room at the men and women arming themselves and repacking their gear for another quick climb.
And I suppose we mean to bludgeon our way up.
Our plan is to be heard,
Knox said,
which means making some noise.
Peter patted his boss on the arm.
Well then, we are already winning.
He left to pick out a gun and top up his canteen. Knox joined Mark and Shirley by the door. Those without guns had armed themselves with fearsome shanks of flattened iron, the edges bright silver from the shrill work of the grinder. It was amazing to Knox that they all knew, instinctively, how to build implements of pain. It was something even shadows knew how to do at a young age, knowledge somehow dredged up from the brutal depths of their imagination, this ability to deal harm to one another. Are the others running behind? Mark asked Knox.
Not too bad, Knox said. More that these guys made good time. The rest will catch up. You guys ready?
Shirley nodded.
Let's get moving, she said.
All right then. Onward and upward, as they say.
Knox scanned the room and watched his mechanics meld with members of supply. More than a few faces were turned his way, waiting for some sign, maybe another speech. But Knox didn't have another one in him. All he had was the fear that he was leading good people to their slaughter, that the taboos were falling in some runaway cascade, and it was all happening much too quickly. Once guns were made, who would unmake them? Barrels rested on shoulders and bristled like pincushions above the crowd. There were things, like spoken ideas, that were almost impossible to take back, and he reckoned his people were about to make many more of them.
On me,
he growled, and the chatter began to die down. Packs rustled into place, pockets jangling with danger.
On me,
he said again to the quieting room, and his soldiers began to form up in columns. Knox turned to the door, thinking this was certainly all on him. He made sure his rifle was covered, tucked it under his arm, and squeezed Shirley's shoulder as she pulled the door open for him. Outside, two workers from supply stood by the railing. They'd been turning the sparse traffic away with a made-up power outage. With the doors open, bright light and the noise of supplies machinery leaked out into the stairwell, and Knox saw what Peter meant by whispers traveling swifter than feet. He adjusted his pack of supplies, the tools, candles, and flashlights that made it seem as if he were marching to aid rather than war. Beneath this beguiling lair were secreted more bullets and an extra bomb, bandages and pain salve for just in case. His rifle was wrapped in a strip of cloth and remained tucked under his arm. Knowing what it was, he found the concealment ridiculous. Looking at the others marching with him, some in welding smocks, some holding construction helmets, he saw their intentions were all too obvious. They left the landing and the light spilling from supply behind and began their climb. Several of his people from mechanical had changed into yellow overalls, the better to blend in the mids. They moved noisily up the dimmed nighttime glow of the stairwell, the shiver of traffic from below giving Knox hope that the rest of his people would be catching up soon. He felt sorry for their weary legs, but reminded himself that they were traveling light. He tried his damnedest to picture the coming morning as positively as he could. Perhaps the clash would conclude before any more of his people arrived. Maybe there would end up being nothing more than a wave of supporters coming to join in the celebrations. Knox and McLean would have already entered the forbidden levels of IT, would have yanked the cover off the inscrutable machinery inside, exposing those evil whirring cogs once and for all. They made good progress while Knox dreamed of a smooth overthrow. They passed one landing where a group of women were hanging laundry over the metal railing to dry. The women spotted Knox and his people in their blue overalls and complained of the power outages. Several of his workers stopped to hand out supplies and to spread lies. It wasn't until after they had left and had wound their way up to the next level that Knox saw the cloth had come unwrapped from Mark's barrel. He pointed this out, and it was fixed before the next landing. The climb turned into a silent, grueling ordeal. Knox let others take the lead while he slid back and checked on the status of his people. Even those in supply he considered his responsibility. Their lives were hanging in the balance of decisions he'd made. It was just as Walker had said, that crazy fool. This was it, an uprising, just like the fables of their youth. And Knox suddenly felt a dire kinship with those old ghosts, those ancestors of myth and lore. Men and women had done this before, maybe for different reasons, with a less noble anger caught in their throats. But somewhere, on some level, there had been a march like this. Similar boots on the same treads. Maybe some of the same boots, just with new soles. All with the jangle of mean machines in hands not afraid to use them. It startled Knox, his sudden link to a mysterious past. And it wasn't that terribly long ago, was it? Less than 200 years? He imagined if someone lived as long as John's had, or McLean for that matter, that 3 long lives could span that distance. 3 handshakes to go from that uprising to this one. And what of the years between? That long peace sandwiched between 2 wars, Knox lifted his boots from one step to another, thinking over these things. Had he become the bad people he'd learned about in youth? Or had he been lied to? It hurt his head to consider, but here he was, leading a revolution. And yet it felt so right, so necessary. What if that former clash had felt the same? Had felt the same in the breasts of the men and women who'd waged it? 50. Methinks I see thee. Now thou art so low, as one dead in the bottom of a tomb. It would take 10 lifetimes to read all these. Juliet looked up from the pile of scattered tins and stacks of thick books. There was more to marvel at in their text-heavy pages than in any of the children's books of her youth. Solo turned from the stove where he was heating soup and boiling water. He waved a dripping metal spoon at the scattered mess she'd made.
I don't think they were meant to be read, he told her. At least not like I've been reading them, front to back.
He touched his tongue to the spoon, then stuck it back in the pot and stirred.
Everything's out of order. It's more like a backup to the backup.
I don't know what that means, Juliet admitted. She looked down at her lap, where pictures of animals called butterflies filled the pages. Their wings were comically bright. She wondered if they were the size of her hands or the size of people. She had yet to find any sense of scale for the beasts.
The servers, Solo said. What did you think I meant? The backup.
He sounded flustered. Juliet watched him busy about the stove, his movements jerky and manic, and realized she was the one cloistered away and ignorant, not him. He had all these books, decades of reading history, the company of ancestors she could only imagine. What did she have as her experience? A life in a dark hole with thousands of fellow ignorant savages? She tried to remember this as she watched him dig a finger in his ear and then inspect his fingernail. The backup of what, exactly? She finally asked, almost afraid of the cryptic answer to come. Solo found two bowls. He began wiping one out with the fabric in the belly of his overalls.
The backup of everything, he said. All that we know. All that ever was.
He set the bowls down and adjusted a knob on the stove.
Follow me,
he said, waving his arm.
I'll show you.
Juliet closed the book and slotted it into its tin. She rose and followed Solo out of the room and into the next one.
Don't mind the mess,
he said, gesturing at a small hill of trash and debris piled up against one wall. It looked like 1,000 empty cans of food, and smelled like 10,000. Juliet wrinkled her nose and fought the reflex to gag. Solo seemed unaffected. He stood beside a small wooden desk and flipped through diagrams hanging from the wall on enormous sheets of paper.
Where's the one I want?
He wondered aloud. What are these? Juliet asked, entranced. She saw one that looked like a schematic of the silo, but unlike any they'd had in mechanical. Solo turned, yet several sheets flopped over one shoulder, his body practically disappearing between the layers of them.
Maps, he said. I want to show you how much is out there. You'll shit yourself.
He shook his head and muttered something to himself.
Sorry, I didn't mean to say that.
Juliet told him it was fine. She held the back of her hand to her nose, the stench of rotting food intolerable.
There it is. Hold this end.
Solo held out the corner of a half dozen sheets of paper. He took the other side, and they lifted them away from the wall. Juliet felt like pointing out the grommets at the bottom of the maps and how they were probably sticks or hooks around here somewhere for propping them up, but held her tongue. Opening her mouth just made the smell of the rotting cans worse.
This is us, Solo said.
He pointed to a spot on the paper. Dark, squiggly lines were everywhere. It didn't look like a map or schematic of anything Juliet had ever seen. It looked like children had drawn it. Hardly a straight line existed anywhere. What's this supposed to show? She asked.
Borders! Land!
Solo ran his hands over one uninterrupted shape that took up nearly a third of the drawing.
This is all water,
he told her. Where? Juliet's arm was getting tired of holding up her end of the sheet. The smell and the riddles were getting to her. She felt a long way from home. The thrill of survival was in danger of being replaced with the depression of a long and miserable existence looming for years and years before her.
Out there, covering the land.
Solo pointed vaguely at the walls. He narrowed his eyes at Juliet's confusion.
The silo, this silo, would be as big around as a single hair on your head.
He patted the map.
Right here, all of them. Maybe all of us left. No bigger than my thumb.
He placed a finger in a knot of lines. Juliet thought he seemed so sincere. She leaned closer to see better, but he pushed her back.
Let those go, he said.
He slapped at her hand holding the corners of paper and smoothed the maps against the wall.
This is us.
He indicated one of the circles on the top sheet. Juliet eyeballed the columns and rows, figured there were 4 dozen or so of them.
Silo 17.
He slid his hand up.
Number 12. This is 8, and silo 1 up here.
No. Juliet shook her head and reached for the desk, her legs weak.
Yes, Silo 1. You're probably from 16 or 18. Do you remember how far you walked?
She grabbed the small chair and pulled it out. Sat down heavily.
How many hills did you cross?
Juliet didn't answer. She was thinking about the other map and comparing the scales. What if Solo was right? What if there were 50 or so silos, and all of them could be covered by a thumb? What if Lucas had been right about how far away the stars were? She needed something to crawl inside, something to cover her. She needed some sleep.
I once heard from Silo 1, Solo said. A long time ago. Not sure how well any of these others are doing.
Wait, Juliet sat up straight. What do you mean you heard from them? Solo didn't turn from the map. He ran his hands from one circle to another, a childlike expression on his face.
They called, checking in.
He looked away from the map and her toward the far corner of the room.
We didn't talk for long. I didn't know all the procedures. They weren't happy.
Okay, but how did you do this? Can we call someone now? Was it a radio? Did it have a little antenna? A small black pointy thing? Juliet stood and crossed to him, grabbed his shoulder and turned him around. How much did this man know that could help her, but that she couldn't get out of him? Solo, how did you talk to them?
Through the wire, he said.
He cupped his hands and covered his ears with them.
You're just talking it.
You need to show me, she said. Solo shrugged. He flipped up a few of the maps again, found the one he wanted, and pressed the others against the wall. It was the schematic of the silo she had seen earlier, a side-on view of it divided into thirds, each third side by side with the others. She helped him hold the other sheets out of the way.
Here are the wires. They run every which way.
He traced thick branches of lines that ran from the exterior walls and off the edges of the paper. They were labeled with minuscule print. Juliet leaned closer to read. She recognized many of the engineering marks. These are for power, she said, pointing at the lines with the jagged symbols above them.
Yep,
Solo nodded.
We don't get our own power anymore. Borrow it from others, I think. All automatic.
You get it from others? Juliet felt her frustration rise. How many crucial things did this man know that he considered trifling? Anything else you want to add? She asked him. Do you have a flying suit that can whisk me back to my silo? Or are there secret passages beneath all the floors so we can just stroll there as easy as we like? Solo laughed and looked at her like she was crazy.
No, he said. Then it would be one seed, not many. One bad day would ruin us all. Besides, the diggers are dead. They buried them.
He pointed at a nook, a rectangular room jutting off from the edge of mechanical. Juliet peered closer. She recognized every floor of the down deep at a glance, but this room wasn't supposed to exist. What do you mean, the diggers?
The machines that removed the dirt, you know, that made this place.
He ran his hand down the length of the silo.
Too heavy to move, I guess, so they poured the walls right over them.
Do they work? Juliet asked. An idea formed. She thought of the mines, of how she'd helped excavate rock by hand. She thought of the sort of machine that could dig out an entire silo, wondered if it could be used to dig between them. Solo clicked his tongue.
No way. Nothing down there does. All toast. Besides,
he chopped his hand partway up the down deep.
There's flooding up to...
He turned to Juliet.
Wait. Are you wanting out? To go somewhere?
He shook his head in disbelief. I want to go home, Juliet said. His eyes widened.
Why would you go back? They sent you away, didn't they? You'll stay here. We don't want to leave.
He scratched his beard and shook his head side to side. Someone has to know about all of this, Juliet told him. All these other people out there, all that space beyond, the people in my silo need to know.
People in your silo already do, he said.
He studied her quizzically, and it dawned on Juliet that he was right. She pictured where they currently stood in the silo. They were in the heart of IT, deep inside the fortress room of the mythical servers, below the servers in a hidden passage, hidden probably even from the people who had access to the innermost kernels of the silo's mysteries. Someone in her own silo did know. It helped keep these secrets for generations, had decided, alone and without input from anyone, what they should and should not know. It was the same man who had sent Juliet to her death, a man who had killed who knew how many more.
Tell me about these wires, Juliet said. How did you talk to the other silo? Give me every detail.
Why?
Solo asked, seemingly shrinking before her. His eyes were wet with fear. Because, she said, I have someone I very much wish to call.
51. This day's black fate on more days doth depend. This but begins the woe others must end. The waiting was interminable. It was the long silence of itchy scalps and trickling sweat, the discomfort of weight on elbows, of backs bent, of bellies flat against an unforgiving conference table. Lucas peered down the length of his fearsome rifle and through the conference room's shattered glass window. Little fragment jewels remained in the side of the jam like transparent teeth. Lucas could still hear, ringing in his ears, the incredible bang from Sims's gun that had taken out the glass. He could still smell the acrid scent of gunpowder in the air, the looks of worry on the faces of the other techs. The destruction had seemed so unnecessary. All this preparation, the toting of massive black guns out of storage, the interruption of his talk with Bernard, news of people coming from the down deep, it all made little sense. He checked the slide on the side of the rifle and tried to remember the 5 minutes of instruction he'd been given hours earlier. There was a round in the chamber. The gun was cocked. More bullets waited patiently in the clip. And the boys in security gave him a hard time for his tech jargon. Lucas's vocabulary had exploded with new terms. He thought about the rooms beneath the servers, the pages and pages of the order, the rows of books he'd only gotten a glimpse of. His mind sagged under the weight of it all. He spent another minute practicing his sighting, looking down the barrel and lining up the small cross in the tiny circle. He aimed at the cluster of conference chairs that had been rolled into an obstructing jumble by the door. For all he knew, they would be waiting like this for days, and nothing would ever happen. It had been a while since any porter had brought an update on what was going on below. For practice, he gently slid his finger into the guard and against the trigger. He tried to get comfortable with the idea of pulling that lever, of fighting the upward kick Sims had told them to expect. Bobby Milner, a shadow no more than 16, made a joke beside him, and Sims told them both to shut the fuck up. Lucas didn't protest at being included in the admonishment. He glanced over at the security gate, where a bristle of black barrels poked through the stanchions and over the metal duty desk. Peter Billings, the new silo sheriff, was over there fiddling with his small gun. Bernard stood behind the sheriff, doling out instructions to his men. Bobby Milner shifted his weight beside Lucas and grunted, trying to get more comfortable. Waiting. More waiting. They were all waiting. Of course, had Lucas known what was coming, he wouldn't have minded. He would have begged to wait there forever. Knox led his group through the 60s with just a few stops for water, a pause to secure their packs and tighten their laces. They passed several curious porters with overnight deliveries who prodded for details about where they were heading, about the blackouts. Each porter left unhappy, and hopefully empty-headed. Peter had been right. The stairwell was singing. It vibrated with the march of too many feet. Those who lived above were generally moving upward, away from the blackouts and toward the promise of power, of warm food and hot showers. Meanwhile, Knox and his people mobilized behind them to squelch a different kind of power. At 56, they had their first spot of trouble. A group of farmers stood outside the hydroponic farm, lowering a cluster of power cables over the railing, presumably toward the small group they had seen the last landing down. When the farmers spotted the blue overalls of Mechanical, one of them called out,
"Hey! We keep you fed. Why can't you keep the juice on?"
"Talk to IT," Mark replied from the front of the queue.
"They're the ones blowing fuses. We're doing what we can." "Well, do it faster," the farmer said. "I thought we just had a rat-damned power holiday to prevent this nonsense."
"We'll have it by lunchtime," Shirley told them. Knox and the others caught up with the head of the group, creating a jam by the landing.
"The faster we get up there, the faster you'll get your juice," Knox explained.
He tried to hold his concealed gun casually, like it was any other tool.
"Well, how about giving us a hand with this tap, then? They've had power on 57 for most of the morning. We'd like enough to get our pumps cranking."
He indicated the trunk of wires coiling over the railing. Knox considered this. What the man was asking for was technically illegal. Challenging him about it would mean delays, but telling him to go ahead might look suspicious. He could sense McLean's group several levels up, waiting on them. Pace and timing were everything.
I can spare two of my men to help out, just as a favor, as long as it doesn't get back to me that Mechanical had shit to do with this.
Like I care, the farmer said. I just want water moving.
Shirley, you and Courtney give them a hand. Catch up when you can.
Shirley's mouth dropped open. She begged with her eyes for him to reconsider.
Get going,
he told her. Mark came to her side. He lifted his wife's pack and handed her his multi-tool. She begrudgingly accepted it, glowered at Knox a moment longer, then turned to go, not saying a word to him or her husband. The farmer let go of the cables and took a step toward Knox.
Hey, I thought you said you'd lend me two of—
Knox leveled a glare harsh enough to make the man pause.
Do you want the best I got?
He asked.
Because you've got it.
The farmer lifted his palms and backed away. Courtney and Shirley could already be heard stomping their way below to coordinate with the men on the lower landing.
Let's go,
Knox said, hitching up his pack. The men and women of Mechanical and Supply lurched forward once more. They left behind the group of farmers on Landing 56, who watched the long column wind its way upward. Whispers rose as the power cables were lowered. Powerful forces were merging over these people's heads, bad intentions coming together and heading for something truly awful. And anyone with eyes and ears could tell, some kind of reckoning was coming. There was no warning for Lucas, no countdown. Hours of quiet anticipation, of insufferable nothingness, simply erupted into violence. Even though he'd been told to expect the worst, Lucas felt like the waiting so long for something to happen just made it a fiercer surprise when it finally did. The double doors of Landing 34 blew open. Solid steel peeled back like curls of paper. The sharp ring made Lucas jump, his hand slip off the stock of his rifle. Gunfire erupted beside him, Bobby Milner shooting at nothing and screaming in fear. Maybe excitement. Sims was yelling impossibly over the roar. When it died down, something flew through the smoke, a canister, bouncing toward the security gate. There was a terrible pause, and then another explosion like a blow to the ears. Lucas nearly dropped his gun. The smoke by the security gate couldn't quite fog the carnage. Pieces of people Lucas had known came to a sick rest in the entrance hall of IT. The people responsible began to surge through before he could take stock, before he could become fearful of another explosion occurring right in front of him. The rifle beside him barked again, and this time Sims didn't yell. This time several other barrels joined in. The people trying to push through the chairs tumbled into them instead, their bodies shaking as if pulled by invisible strings, arcs of red like hurled paint flying from their bodies. More came, a large man with a throaty roar. Everything moved so slowly. Lucas could see the man's mouth part, a yell in the center of a burly beard, a chest as wide as two men. He held a rifle at his waist. He fired at the ruined security station. Lucas watched Peter Billing spin to the floor, clutching his shoulder. Bits of glass shivered from the window frame in front of Lucas as barrel after barrel erupted across the conference table, the shattered window seeming insignificant now. A prudent move. The hail of bullets hit the man unseen. The conference room was an ambush, a side-on attack. The large man shook as some of the wildfire got lucky. His beard sagged open as his mouth parted. His rifle was cracked in half, a shiny bullet between his fingers. He tried to reload. The guns of IT loosed their own bullets too fast to count. Levers were held, and springs and gunpowder did the rest. The giant man fumbled with his rifle but never got it reloaded. He tumbled into the chairs, sending them crashing across the floor. Another figure appeared through the door, a tiny woman. Lucas watched her down the length of his barrel, saw her turn and look right at him, the smoke from the explosion drifting toward her, white hair flowing about her shoulders as if the smoke were a part of her. He could see her eyes. He'd yet to shoot his gun, had watched, jaw slack, as the fighting took place. The woman bent her arm back and made to throw something his way. Lucas pulled the trigger. His rifle flashed and lurched. In the time it took, the long and terrible time it took for the bullet to cross the room, he realized it was just an old woman, holding something. A bomb. Her torso spun and her chest blossomed red. The object fell.
There was another awful wait, more attackers appearing, screaming in anger, until an explosion blew the chairs and the people among them apart. Lucas wept while a second surge made a futile attempt. He wept until his clip was empty, wept as he fumbled for the release, shoved despair into the butt, the salt bitter on his lips as he drew back that bolt and let loose with another menacing hail of metal, so much stouter and quicker than the flesh it met. 52. I have seen the day that I have worn a visor and could tell a whispering tale. Bernard came to at the sound of shouting, his eyes burning from the smoke, his ears ringing with a long-ago blast. Peter Billings was shaking his shoulders, yelling at him, a look of fright in his wide eyes and on his soot-stained brow. Blood stained his overalls in a wide, rust-colored pool.
Sir, can you hear me?
Bernard pushed Peter's hands away and tried to sit up. He groped about his body, looking for anything bleeding or broken. His head throbbed. His hand came away from his nose, wet with blood.
What happened? He groaned.
Peter crouched by his side. Bernard saw Lucas standing at a distance behind the sheriff, rifle on his shoulder, peering toward the stairwell. There was shouting in the distance, and then the patter of gunfire.
We've got 3 men dead, Peter said. A few wounded. Sims led a half dozen into the stairwell. They got it a lot worse than us. A lot worse.
Bernard nodded. He checked his ears, was surprised they weren't bleeding as well. He dotted his sleeve with blood from his nose and patted Peter on the arm. He nodded over his shoulder.
Get Lucas, he said.
Peter frowned but nodded. He spoke with Lucas, and the young man knelt by Bernard.
Are you okay?
Lucas asked. Bernard nodded.
Stupid, he said. Didn't know they'd have guns. Should have guessed about the bombs.
Take it easy.
He shook his head.
Shouldn't have had you here. Dumb. Could have been us both.
Well, it was neither of us, sir. We've got him running down the stairwell. I think it's over.
Bernard patted his arm.
Get me to the server, he said. We'll need to report this.
Lucas nodded. He knew which server Bernard meant. He helped Bernard to his feet, an arm around his back, Peter Billings frowning as the two of them staggered down the smoky hallway together.
Not good,
Bernard told Lucas, once they were away from the others.
But we won, right?
Not yet. The damage won't be contained here. Not today. You'll have to stay below a while.
Bernard grimaced and tried to walk alone.
Can't risk something happening to us both.
Lucas seemed unhappy about this. He entered his code into the great door, pulled out his ID, wiped someone else's blood off it and his hand, then swiped it through the reader.
I understand, he finally said.
Bernard knew he'd picked the right man. He left Lucas to close the heavy door while he made his way to the rearmost server. He staggered once and fell against number 8, catching himself and resting a moment until the wooziness went away. Lucas caught up and was pulling his copy of the master key out of his overalls before Bernard got to the back of the room. Bernard rested against the wall while Lucas opened the server. He was still too shaken up to notice the flashing code on the server's front panel. His ears were too full of a false ringing to notice the real one.
What's that mean?
Lucas asked.
That noise.
Bernard looked at him quizzically.
Fire alarm?
Lucas pointed up at the ceiling. Bernard finally heard it as well. He stumbled toward the back of the server as Lucas opened the last lock, pushed the young man out of the way.
What were the chances? Did they already know?
Bernard's life had become unhinged in 2 short days. He reached inside the cloth pouch, grabbed the headset, and pulled it over his tender ears. He pushed the jack into the slot labeled 1, and was surprised to hear a beep. The line was ringing. He was making a call. He pulled the jack out hurriedly, canceling the call, and saw that the light above 1 wasn't blinking, the light above 17 was. Bernard felt the room spin. A dead silo was calling him.
A survivor? After all these years? With access to the servers?
His hand trembled as he guided the jack into the slot. Lucas was asking something behind him, but Bernard couldn't hear anything through the headphones.
Hello? He croaked. Hello? Is anyone there?
Hello?
A voice said. Bernard adjusted his headphones. He waved for Lucas to shut the fuck up. His ears were still ringing, his nose bleeding into his mouth.
Who is this? He asked. Can you hear me?
I hear you, the voice said. Is this who I think it is?
Who the fuck is this? Bernard sputtered. How do you have access to—
You sent me out, the voice said. You sent me to die.
Bernard slumped down, his legs numb. The cord on the headphones uncoiled and nearly pulled the cups from his head. He clutched the headphones and fought to place this voice. Lucas was holding him by the armpits, keeping him from collapsing onto his back.
Are you there? The voice asked. Do you know who this is?
No,
he said. But he knew. It was impossible, but he knew.
You sent me to die, you fuck!
You knew the rules,
Bernard cried, yelling at a ghost.
You knew!
Shut up and listen, Bernard. Just shut the fuck up and listen to me very carefully.
Bernard waited. He could taste the copper of his own blood in his mouth.
I'm coming for you. I'm coming home, and I'm coming to clean.
The world is not thy friend, nor the world's law. Villain and he be many miles asunder. And all these woes shall serve for sweet discourses in our time to come. He that is struck and blind cannot forget the precious treasure of his eyesight lost. One fire burns out another's burning. One pain is lessened by another's anguish. The Tragic History of Romeus and Juliet. Part 5. The Stranded. 53. Silo 18. Mark stumbled down the great stairway, his hand sliding against the cool railing, a rifle tucked under his arm, his boots slipping in blood. He could barely hear the screams all around him, the wails from the wounded as they were half-dragged down the steps, the horrified cries from the curious crowds on every landing who witnessed their passage, or the shouts of promised violence from the men chasing him and the rest of his mechanics from level to level. The ringing in his ears drowned out most of the noise. It was the blast, the god-awful blast. Not the one that had peeled open the doors of IT, he had been ready for that one, had hunkered down with the rest. And it wasn't the second bomb, the one Knox had lobbed deep into the heart of their enemy's den. It was the last one, the one he didn't see coming, the one that spilled from the hands of that small white-haired woman from supply. McLean's bomb. It had gone off right in front of him, had taken his hearing as it took her life. And Knox, that stout and unmovable head of mechanical, his boss, his good friend, gone. Mark hurried down the steps, wounded and afraid. He was a long way from the safety of the down deep, and he desperately wanted to find his wife. He concentrated on this rather than the past, tried not to think of the explosion that had taken his friends, had wrecked their plans, had engulfed any chance at justice. Muffled shots rang out from above, followed by the piercing zing of bullets striking steel. Only steel, thank God. Mark stayed away from the outer railing, away from the aim of the shooters who hounded them from the landings above with their smoothly firing rifles. The good people of mechanical and supply had been running and fighting for over a dozen levels. Mark silently begged the men above to stop, to give them a chance to rest, but the boots and the bullets kept coming. Half a level later, he caught up to three members of supply, the one in the middle wounded and being carried, his arms draped over shoulders, blood dotting the backs of their yellow overalls. He yelled at them to keep moving, couldn't hear his own voice, could just feel it in his chest. Some of the blood he was slipping in was his own. With his injured arm tight against his chest, his rifle cradled in the crook of his elbow, Mark kept his other hand on the railing to keep from tumbling headfirst down the steep stairwell. There were no allies behind him, none still alive. After the last shootout, he had sent the others ahead, had barely gotten away himself. And yet they kept coming, tireless. Mark would pause now and then, fumble with the unreliable ammunition, chamber a shot, and fire wildly up the stairwell. Just to do something, to slow them down. He stopped to take a breath, leaned out over the railing, and swung his rifle toward the sky. The next round was a dud. The bullets buzzing back at him weren't. Huddling against the stairwell's central post, he took the time to reload. His rifle wasn't like theirs, one shot at a time and difficult to aim. They had modern things he'd never heard of, shots coming as fast as a frightened pulse. He moved toward the railing and checked the landing below, could see curious faces through a cracked doorway, fingers curled around the edge of the steel jamb. This was it. Landing 56. The last place he'd seen his wife. Shirley! Calling her name, he staggered down a quarter turn until he was level with the landing. He kept close to the interior, out of sight from his pursuers, and searched the shadowed faces.
My wife!
He yelled across the landing, a hand cupped to his cheeks, forgetting that the incredible ringing was only in his ears, not theirs.
Where is she?
A mouth moved in the dark crowd. The voice was a dull and distant drone. Someone else pointed down. The faces cringed. The cracked door twitched shut as another ricochet screamed out. The stairway shook with all the frightened boots below and the chasing ones above. Mark eyed the illicit power cables draped over the railing and remembered the farmers attempting to steal electricity from the level below. He hurried down the stairs, following the thick cords, desperate to find Shirley. One level down, positive that his wife would be inside, Mark braved the open space of the landing and rushed across. He threw himself against the doors. Shots rang out. Mark grabbed the handle and tugged, shouting her name to ears as deaf as his own. The door budged, was being held fast with the sinewy restraint of unseen arms. He slapped the glass window, leaving a pink palm print, and yelled for them to open up, to let him in. Eager bullets rattled by his feet. One of them left a scar down the face of the door. Crouching and covering his head, he scurried back to the stairwell. Mark forced himself to move downward. If Shirley was behind those doors, she might be better off. She could strip herself of incriminating gear, blend in until things settled down. If she was below, he needed to hurry after her. Either way, down was the only direction. At the next landing, he caught up with the same three members of supply he'd passed earlier. The wounded man was sitting on the decking, eyes wide. The other two were tending to him, blood on their sides from supporting his weight. One of the supply workers was a woman Mark vaguely recognized from the march up. There was a cold fire in her eyes as Mark paused to see if they needed help.
I can carry him,
he shouted, kneeling by the wounded man. The woman said something. Mark shook his head and pointed to his ears. She repeated herself, lips moving in exaggeration, but Mark wasn't able to piece it together. She gave up and shoved at his arm, pushing him away. The wounded man clutched his stomach, a red stain ballooning out from his abdomen all the way to his crotch. His hands clasped something protruding there, a small wheel spinning on the end of a steel post, the leg of a chair. The woman pulled a bomb from her satchel, one of those pipes that promised so much violence. It was solemnly passed to the wounded man, who accepted it, his knuckles white, his hands trembling. The two members of supply pulled Mark away, away from the man with a large piece of office furniture sprouting from his oozing stomach. The shouts sounded distant, but he knew they were nearby. They were practically in his ear. He found himself yanked backward, transfixed by the vacant stare on the face of this doomed and wounded man. His eyes locked onto Mark's. The man held the bomb away from himself, fingers curled around that terrible cylinder of steel, a grim clench of teeth jutting along his jawline. Mark glanced up the stairwell, where the boots were finally gaining on them, coming into view, black and bloodless, this tireless and superior enemy. They came down the dripping trail Mark and the others had left behind, coming for them with their ammo that never failed. He stumbled down the stairwell backward, half dragged by the others, one hand on the railing, eyes drifting to the swinging door opening behind the man they'd left behind. A young face appeared there, a curious boy, rushing out to sea. A tangle of adult hands scrambled to pull him back. Mark was hauled down the curving stairs, too far down to see what happened next. But his ears, as deadened as they were, caught the popping and zinging of gunfire, and then a blast, a roaring explosion that shook the great stairwell, that knocked him and the others down, slamming him against the railing. His rifle clattered toward the edge. Mark lunged for it. He grabbed it before it could escape and go tumbling into space. Shaking his head, stunned, he pushed himself up to his hands and knees and managed to rise slowly to his feet. Senseless, he staggered forward down the shuddering steps, the treads beneath his feet ringing and vibrating as the silo around them all continued its spiral into dark madness. 54. Silo 18.
The first moment of true rest came hours later at supply, on the upper edge of the down deep. There was talk of holding there, of setting up some kind of barrier, but it wasn't clear how the entire stairway could be blocked to include the open space between the railing and the concrete cylinder beyond. This was the gap where the singing bullets lived, a place where jumpers were known to meet their ends, and where their enemy could surely find some way to scamper down. Mark's hearing had improved during the last leg of his run, enough to grow weary of the rhythmic clomp of his own boots, the sound of his pained grunts, the noise of his exhausted pants for air. He heard someone say that the last explosion had wrecked the stairway, had impeded the chase. But for how long? What was the damage? No one knew. Tensions ran high in the landing. The news of McLean's death had unsettled the people of supply. The wounded in yellow overalls were taken inside, but it was suggested, and not gently, that mechanicals injured would be better off receiving treatment further below, where they belonged. Mark waded through these arguments, the voices still somewhat muffled and distant. He asked everyone about Shirley, several in yellow shrugging as if they didn't know her. One guy said she'd already gone down with some of the other wounded. He said it a second time, louder, before Mark was sure he'd heard him. It was good news, and he'd figured as much. He was about to leave when his wife emerged without warning from the anxious crowd, startling him. Her eyes widened as she recognized him, and then her gaze fell to his wounded arm.
Oh, God!
She threw her arms around him, pressed her face against his neck. Mark hugged her with one arm, his rifle between them, the barrel cold against his quivering cheek.
Are you okay?
He asked. She latched onto his neck, her forehead finding his shoulder, and said something he couldn't hear but could feel against his skin. She made room to inspect his arm.
I can't hear, he told her. I'm fine, she said, louder.
She shook her head, her eyes wide and wet.
I wasn't there for any of it. Is it true about Knox? What happened? How bad was it?
She focused on his wound, and her hands felt good on his arm, strong and confident. The crowd was thinning as members of Mechanical retreated further down the stairwell. Several in supply yellow treated Mark to cold stares, eyeing his wound as if worried it would soon be their problem.
Knox is dead, he told her. McLean, too. A few others. I was right there when the blast went off.
He looked down at his arm, which she had exposed by tearing away his ripped and stained undershirt.
Were you shot?
She asked. He shook his head.
I don't know. It happened so fast.
He looked over his shoulder.
Where's everyone going? Why aren't we holding up here?
Shirley set her teeth and jerked her head at the door, which was too deep with yellow overalls.
Don't think we're wanted, she said,
her voice raised so he could hear.
I've got to clean this wound. I think some of the bomb is in you. I'm fine, he insisted. I've just been looking for you. I've been worried sick.
He saw that his wife was crying, unbroken tear tracks standing out amid the beads of sweat.
I thought you were gone, she said.
He had to read her lips to make it out.
I thought they had... that you were...
She bit her lip and stared at him with uncharacteristic fear. Mark had never seen his wife fazed, not by a sprung casement leak, not by a cave-in deep in the mine that trapped several of their close friends, not even when Juliet was sent to cleaning. But heaps of dread were locked up in her expression now, and that scared him in a way the bombs and bullets couldn't.
Let's hurry after the others, he said,
taking her hand. He could feel the exposed nerves on the landing, the gazes begging them to be off. When shouts rang down from above once more, and the members of supply retreated to the safety of their doorway, Mark knew this brief moment of respite was over. But it was okay. He'd found his wife. She was unharmed. There was little anyone could do to him now. When they reached 139 together, Mark knew they'd made it. His legs had somehow held out. The blood loss hadn't stopped him. With his wife helping him along, they passed the last landing before Mechanical, and all he could think about was holding the line against those bastards who were taking shots at them from above. Inside Mechanical, they would have power, safety in numbers, the advantage of home turf. More importantly, they would be able to bandage wounds and get some rest. That's what he sorely needed. Rest. He nearly tripped and fell down the last few steps, his legs not used to an end to the descent, a flat piece of ground rather than one more tread to sink to. As his knees buckled and Shirley caught him, he finally noticed the jam of people at the security station leading into mechanical. The crew that had stayed behind while the rest marched up to fight had been busy. Steel plates had been welded solid across the wide security entrance. The diamond-studded sheeting stood from floor to ceiling, wall to wall. Sparks hissed along one edge as someone worked to complete the job from the inside. The sudden flurry of refugees and wounded amassed in a crowd desperate to get in. Mechanics shoved and jostled against the barrier. They screamed and beat on the steel plates, mad with fear.
"What the hell?" Mark cried.
He followed Shirley as she pressed into the back of the crowd. At the front, someone was crawling on the floor, wiggling on their belly through the tightest of gaps, a rectangle left open below the security turnstile wide enough to slide through, easy enough to defend.
"Maisie, wait your turn,"
someone ahead of them shouted. Yellow overalls were mixed in with the others. Some were mechanics who had donned disguises. Some seemed to be from supply, helping the wounded, mixed up in the wrong crowd, or not trusting their own level for safety. As Mark attempted to usher Shirley toward the front, a shot rang out, the thwack and clatter of a hot ball of lead striking nearby. He changed direction and pulled her back toward the stairs. The crush around the impossibly small entrance grew frantic. There was a lot of yelling back and forth through the hole, people on this side shouting that they were being shot at, those on the other side yelling, "One at a time!" Several were on their bellies, scrambling for the tiny hole. One got his arms inside and was pulled through, sliding across the steel grating and disappearing into the dark space. Two others tried to be next, jostling for position. They were all exposed to the open stairwell above. Another shot rang out, and someone fell, clutching his shoulder and screaming, "I'm hit!" The throng dispersed. Several ran back to the stairs, where the overhang of the treads protected them from the gunfire. The rest were in chaos, all trying to fit through a space expressly designed to allow no more than one at a time. Shirley screamed and squeezed Mark's arm as another person was shot nearby. A mechanic fell to the ground and doubled over in pain. Shirley yelled at her husband, asking him what they should do. Mark dropped his rucksack, kissed her cheek, and ran with his rifle back up the stairs. He tried to take them two at a time, but his legs were too sore. Another shot rang out, the ricochet of a miss. His body felt incredibly heavy, slow like in a bad dream. He approached the landing of 139 with his gun level, but the shooters were further up, peppering the crowd from higher above. He checked that he had a fresh round in the home-built gun, cocked it, and edged out onto the landing. Several men in the gray of security were leaning out over the railing above, barrels trained down toward the ground floor of mechanical. One of the men tapped his neighbor and pointed toward Mark. Mark watched all this down the length of his own barrel. He fired a shot, and a black rifle tumbled toward him from above, the arms of its wielder slumping over the railing before sagging down and disappearing. Gunfire erupted, but he was already diving back toward the stairs. The shouting grew furious both above and below him. Mark went to the other side of the stairs, away from where he'd last been seen, and peered down. The crowd was thinning by the security barrier. More and more people were being pulled through. He could see Shirley looking up, shielding her eyes against the stairway lights above. Boots rang out behind him. Mark reloaded, turned, and aimed at the highest step he could see along the upward spiral. He waited for whatever was heading down toward him. When the first boot appeared, he steadied himself, allowed more of the man to sink before his barrel, and then he pulled the trigger. Another black rifle clattered against the steps and bounced through the railing. Another man sagged to his knees. Mark turned and ran. He lost his grip on his own gun, felt it bang against his shins as it skittered away from him, and he didn't stop to retrieve it. He slid down the steps, lost his footing, landed on his ass, and bounced back up. He tried taking the steps two at a time, was running as if in a dream, not fast enough, legs like rusted steel. There was a bang, a muffled roar behind him, and somehow someone had caught up, had punched him in the back, had hit him. Mark sprawled forward and bounced down the steps, his chin striking the steel treads. Blood poured into his mouth. He tried to crawl, got his feet beneath him, and stumbled forward. Another roar, another punch to the back, the feeling that he'd been bitten and kicked at the same time.
"This is what it feels like to be shot," he thought numbly.
He spilled down the last few steps, lost sensation in his legs, crashed to the grating.
The bottom floor was nearly empty. One person stood beside the tiny hole. Another was half in and half out, boots kicking. Mark saw that it was Shirley, on her belly, looking back at him. They were both lying on the floor, so comfortable on the